Welcome to Policy Speaking, a podcast that checks in every week with the people at the center of the debates about where Canadian policy should be headed, especially in the wake of the COVID-19 crisis. We speak with the thinkers, doers, and deciders about how good policy can make for a better Canada. We'll be putting out a new episode every Thursday, so please join us weekly if you're up for a deep dive into the policy choices in front of us and the trade-offs involved. Here's the host of Policy Speaking, Edward Greenspan, President and CEO of the Public Policy Forum and former Editor-in-Chief of the Globe and Mail.
Thanks for tuning in. I'm Edward Greenspan, and today we will be joined by Bruce Lurie and Janet Ansley to unpack the 2021-22 federal budget through an energy and environment lens. Should be interesting because there's a lot going on in that field, as we've seen. But first, we will have a chat with our executive producer, Katie Davey. Welcome back. I've done it again. Welcome back, Katie.
Thanks, Ed. So we now have, we're 10 days away from the federal budget actually being released. And I think it's kind of interesting because this budget was 800 pages long. From your perspective, you know, with your long career in journalism, how do you go about actually kind of meaningfully covering a document that is 800 pages long that you get, you know, 2 hours, 3 hours before you have to file? Like, what would that process look like?
Yeah, I mean, I remember reading an 800-page novel a couple of years ago. I think it was called Fate and Death by Vasily Grossman, about, it's sort of a War and Peace equivalent of Russia. And, you know, it was a good week on the beach. So that's a lot of reading. I mean, beautiful illustrated charts and things of that sort, but still a lot of reading. You know, if you're a journalist covering a budget, you go into, in normal times, particularly, you go into a lockup and you get to see, and you have to hand in your cell phone, you have to hand in anything that would allow you to communicate out. And you're in this big cavern with, you know, several hundred other journalists and some economists and people like that. And you start going through the budget looking for the highlights. You know, 770 or whatever pages it was, almost as I say, 800 pages, would be a big challenge. In that hallway at the lockup, there are finance officials who come, you know, from the Department of Finance. And I would think you become even more captive to them because you have less time to really, you know, go through everything yourself. And there were a lot of things, you know, in that budget, even in areas that I'm pretty familiar with, like energy and environment areas, that were confusing. And the days after, I was talking to people, you know, they're still confusing. And if they're confusing, it's because people haven't still settled after 2 years between budgets on exactly what they want to say about carbon capture and utilization, for instance. You know, they haven't settled on childcare, despite it being the centerpiece. Of course, in a country like Canada, with Fed-Prov relations, it's difficult to settle. I guess the last thing I'd say is that the most important budget that I covered in a lockup, and I've probably been in about 10 lockups, 12 lockups over the years, was the Paul Martin, John Chrétien 1995 budget, which was a very seminal budget in terms of bringing the deficit into order and shrinking government and the size of the federal government and shrinking almost every department. I think every department except what was then called Indian and Northern Affairs. And it was under 200 pages. So this was a big budget. There was a lot of things to throw at a lot of people.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what strikes me. You know, there's things in this budget that in, I guess, a normal budget year, maybe if you can call it that, would have gotten tons of attention that really haven't even seen the light of day yet. So I think that'll be something kind of interesting moving forward. You know, I think of some of the changes they made to student loans and repayment. Like, that would normally be a pretty big kind of pillar, and I'm barely even seeing student organizations talk about it, quite frankly. So, you know, I think the other piece too that I've heard a little bit is the energy and climate stuff has kind of been a bit of an unsung hero. And I know you'll get into that today, but it also comes at a time when, you know, we had a major global climate summit really a couple of days later. So actually, I guess I'm trying to think now, is this our first big summit we've had during the pandemic, Ed?
I think there's been, you know, other summits, even on energy, you know, G20 summits and things of this sort. But, you know, this is certainly the, I think it was, you know, meant to be the heralding of the United States returning to the let's fight climate change movement. And let's talk about this for a minute, but I also want to come back to childcare, because that was, you know, meant to be the main theme of the government. I think some other stuff didn't have as much detail, perhaps because they didn't want to detract from the main message, which is after all these many years, we are determined to push ahead on childcare. And the minister and the first female minister of finance in the history of the country is determined to push ahead on childcare. So let's come back to that in a minute, because I know you've been doing some work at the Public Policy Forum on that as well. On climate, you know, there were a couple of big things. You know, part of the, you know, really important part of it was that the government committed itself very strongly to expanding carbon capture and storage in Canada, which is the idea of there will be some carbon that we can't get out of our system, whether it's in airplanes or whether it's in steel and cement plants. There are technologies that are at work even there, but there's certain carbons we won't be looking at our system. And we will still have a lot of internal combustion engine cars. I mean, you know, 98% of the cars on the road today are internal combustion engines. So even if we have a rapid flip, it's not going to happen by 2030. You know, maybe we get to 50-50. Even that would be a stretch. History is moving in one direction, but it can't move instantly in that direction. So therefore, you want to bury some of that carbon. And that's a fairly expensive proposition. Canada happens to have some of the best, if you'll put it, burial grounds for carbon in the world. And often it gets buried from where it's taken. You know, the UK has a big program going to take carbon back to the North Sea and put it back in there. So there was a lot of discussion around that, and a promise of an investment tax credit for it, as there's one like that in the United States, but a 90-day consultation period. There's been a lot of consultation going on, but they felt that more consultations needed. So, you know, we'll have to see where that goes. You know, we'll talk about that, I'm sure, a little bit later in our interview today. But that, you know, was a subtext theme, major theme of the budget. But as I said, childcare was number one. So tell me what you thought of the childcare work and how it dovetails with the work you're leading at PPF.
Yeah, well, there's no question that was both intentionally and frankly the centerpiece of the budget. I think honestly, and you know, I've obviously been following folks' reaction to this. It really was, I think, a breathtaking commitment. Frankly, like right now, the federal government spends only about, you know, $1 billion to $2 billion a year on childcare, like, you know, through transfers, direct transfers to the provinces. And that ranges from, you know, I think in Ontario, only about a couple percent of the overall childcare budget. And this budget, it didn't really lay out details, frankly. It laid out, and, you know, budgets don't necessarily do that, but it did lay out a couple of key principles and some numbers, right? So one of those, of course, is in by 5 years, getting childcare costs to about $10 a day across the country. And to do that, being kind of a 50-50 partner with the provinces. So that's an obvious major signal. It puts stakes in the ground. It doesn't say how they're going to do that necessarily, but it puts big stakes in the ground. And really, that piece is the foundational piece that to which they'll, I guess, build their system on. I say their system, that's not fair. Build kind of their commitment to the system. But they're going to have to do this, and they've been clear, through bilateral agreements. They're going to negotiate bilateral agreements individually with every province.
So by that, you mean one-on-one with each of the provinces, not a collective national agreement?
That's exactly right. So they'll negotiate individually with each province, meaning that the agreements will be different in every single province. In some ways, that's good because it provides flexibility for, you know, systems that already exist. There are a number of provinces over the last number of years that have taken childcare quite seriously and have started to try to redesign their system a bit. So I think that will really, you know, be kind of supported through the bilaterals. obviously a Quebec bilateral would look very different than any other, because the Quebec system is really, frankly, the one they're modeling their commitment on, the federal government's commitment on.
Let me interject with just a quick question here, because you mentioned the 50-50. And, you know, you've worked in a provincial government. So right now, if you're in a provincial government, you're fiscally hard-pressed, even more so perhaps probably than Ottawa. And you have rising healthcare costs and an aging population. So the federal government gives you 50 cents to do something that's popular and good, but you got to put up the other 50 cents and you have this tremendous pressure on you on the healthcare side already. So how does that go down in a province?
Yeah, well, Ed, it's funny you ask, because I'm working on an op-ed right now in the New Brunswick context that answers that exact question. But, you know, I think what's important to note is that the government, the federal government rather, didn't say, hey, we need you to commit, you provinces to commit 50% to this. That's not at all what they said. They've actually said the exact opposite, which is, hey, provinces, right now, we, the federal government, don't spend very much money on childcare. We're going to kick in a whole bunch of money, and we just want you to be a 50% partner here. So really, in some cases, quite frankly, it's not going to mean that provinces can reduce their personal commitments at all, but it will mean that their dollars will be able to be spread differently because the federal government is coming in as a 50-50 partner. So, you know, the provinces and individual families are now not going to have to be, you know, the 85 to 90% contributors like they are right now. They're going to be able to be met halfway by the federal government. It's not the federal government saying, hey, you have to spend a whole bunch of more money to meet these objectives. It's actually exactly the opposite. They're saying, here are the objectives we want, you know, we think we want to meet, and we're going to give you a whole bunch of money to meet those. Because again, the provinces are already by and large contributing a ton of money to childcare. They just don't really have help from the federal government right now.
What and when will the contribution be that you're making through the childcare initiative that you're involved with within the public policy forum? When will we see something, and what sort of thing will we see?
Yeah, so what we've done at PPF is actually we've engaged with about 200 people over the last 6 months, and they range from childcare experts to childcare providers. So we've heard of, and from every province, we've heard a lot about the system, a lot. And really, we approached this process with the kind of foundational question of, you know, the federal government has said they're going to become a partner in childcare. How will they do that? And from there, you know, we had two very key questions. It was that jurisdictional question, right? This, you know, this bilateral piece, like how can the federal government actually spend money in childcare when it's a provincial jurisdiction? That's question one. And that still remains a question, quite frankly. You know, they've said they're going to spend money. Great. If the provinces say no, thank you, well, they're not going to be able to. So that's a big piece of the pie. And what we heard actually from the folks that we spoke to was that to create any actual meaningful system change in childcare, you've got to have sustainable funding that's large enough so the provinces actually will feel comfortable making massive changes. Because what is needed in most provinces, frankly, is massive changes. So you need predictability and sustainability of funding. So that's kind of part one. And I think, you know, the federal government is trying to do that. But on the other side, what we're looking at is quality. So this is one thing the federal government did not do well in the budget, was actually talk about how they're going to create spaces, right? And that's majorly workforce development. And not only that, but the top thing we heard, didn't matter who we were talking to in the childcare sector, the key issue with the sector right now and the reason why there's such high staff turnover is wages and working conditions. So if the federal government, frankly, is not willing to have that be part of the bilateral agreements, the system's not going to change. It's not going to improve because, you know, on average right now, childcare providers make about $35,000 a year.
Yeah, I'm glad we're looking at that issue, because it seems to me that a lot of the discussion so far around this secession and what we can do has been around getting more parents who tend to be the childcare providers, of course, are overwhelmingly women still. No great reason for that, but that's the way it is. And getting more of them to be able to get into the workforce and increase their labor market participation. And that's a fine and important goal for the economy, for people's ability to express themselves as they want. Women, who want to work, having that ability to work. The less attention, I guess, I've heard has been on the question of, what's the best way to do this for the children? And of course, that requires quality of provider. And that's got to be, I agree with you, a bigger part of it. And it might be that it means quality might mean fewer spaces. There's potential trade-off there that I guess we'll watch people wrestle with that difficult question. But, that's what they should be doing, wrestling with the difficult question.
Well, and that's exactly it. And quite frankly, what our paper is going to argue, and it'll be released on May 25th, but what it's going to argue is you can't achieve accessibility, affordability, and quality without a substantial investment in workforce development. That's the only way you can achieve those three goals. And those are broadly the three goals that any childcare system should and wants to achieve. And so that really is where a huge investment's going to be. And they have to be, again, good paying jobs, not, to your point, we can't just look at this sector as a way for women to enter the workforce. Like, we have to also look at how the sector itself is shaped and recognize, again, to your point, that it is predominantly women, and that, any investment needs to also be an investment in the actual workforce of childcare. So yeah, we're excited. The report will be out on May 26th or May 25th rather.
Okay, so my philosophy would be never to give a precise date. Near the end of May, just in case, stuff happens. There's a pandemic you weren't expecting, whatever. So, okay, but you're on the line now.
I'm on the line. And it's funny you say that because, as you know, Ed, I've had a computer crash. And so here's one obstacle already. But the reason is it'll be released at the YMCA Canada's AGM. And so they've given me a firm date. I've got to hit it.
Okay, so we're going to talk about energy and environment and carbon capture and the increase in Canada's Paris commitments, the long-term net zero commitment with Bruce Laurie and Janet Annesley in a moment. And, we also have an Energy Future Forum, as you know, Katie, and it met a couple times last week. And I heard a lot about the budget and how the budget might come down. And I'd say there was one question that was really interestingly fundamental, and that's everywhere in the world, carbon capture is being discussed or looked at or being developed in Norway and the United Kingdom and the United States and China, throughout much of the world. And Canada was once a leader there. There's a sense of being a leader again. But there's a kind of fundamental question, to what extent is this a cost where the public sector for this public good has to sink a cost? And to what extent is this an opportunity to get ahead in a new business? And, I wrote an op-ed in November saying that we should be talking about a keystone of carbon, carrying carbon back and forth across the border to bury it or to use it in different ways, which already happens, by the way, on the Saskatchewan, North Dakota border with one of our early carbon capture projects in Canada. So we'll get into this and other questions with Bruce and Janet in the moment. I guess it's probably worth me telling people that this podcast interview was also a live event that PPF did, a member event. So this conversation, took place in that context as well, as will become apparent because there's at least one audience question, I think, that we'll hear in this session.
Yeah, sounds great, Ed. I look forward to learning a lot from this.
Okay, me too. So moving on now to our feature, Policy Speaking interview. It's my pleasure to introduce Bruce Laurie, noted environmentalist, president of the Ivy Foundation, good friend of the Public Policy Forum, to join us today. And Janet Ansley, who's a recently minted public policy fellow, Forum Fellow, and Senior Director, Energy and ESG at Invest Alberta Corporation. And I will ask them to help us deconstruct the evolving plans of the transition to a low carbon economy as we have seen the evolution this week, both in the budget and in the summit that took place with President Joe Biden as well. So Janet, let me start with you. There was a great deal of talk pre-budget and some strategic leaking, even that the oil industry and Alberta were looking for help with a big move into carbon capture, talk of $30 billion over 10 years. We did see an investment tax credit in the budget meant to catch up with the United States on carbon capture, but 90 days of consultation in place of detail. So how is this budget playing in the oil industry and in Alberta?
Yeah, usually, indeed, a federal budget isn't cause for a whole lot of attention in Alberta. You know, it's pretty business as usual, but this budget's got everyone's attention, not just because of COVID, but as you point out about the additional details that it contains on how to support, you know, some of our major economic sectors in the transition to a low carbon future. And in, you know, the mention of CCUS, you talked about, you know, the high profile dialogue between the provincial government and the federal government to begin looking at how carbon capture use and storage can come more to the fore in Canada. And, you know, you mentioned the oil industry in your opening remarks, Ed, but I just want to, you know, point out that actually CCUS has really broad application. And it's not just one application to one sector, it's different applications. There's different technologies on the capture side. There's different needs and methods of transportation. There's going to be carbon uses. The budget also mentioned EOR, enhanced oil recovery, which has been a well-known and proven use in Canada. And of course, the geological sequestration over the longer term.
But it does mention enhanced oil recovery, something that it doesn't want to support with CCS, right?
Correct. It says the intent is that the investment tax credit would not be used for EOR. But I think we still have to figure out what that means. You know, so while the budget announced the investment tax credit, you know, it's, is this a glass half empty or half full? Well, I would say it's, you know, Albertans are looking at it as half full, but what is it full of? Is it full of grape juice or is it full of baby duck? You know, we don't know right now because we have to have this 90-day consultation about the investment tax credit, what level it will be at. And you mentioned on how that can help us compete with the United States. You know, the United States has taken a vastly different tack to CCUS. So they've been working a number of years on a combination of different tax credits and different granting incentive programs. They're largely known as this sort of 45Q structure. And we don't really have an analogy to that in Canada. Probably the best we can get at is an investment tax credit type of tool. But the magic for I think all companies and entities looking at CCUS as a potential solution will be, you know, what kind of incentive will this offer? The US has been really down, not down a federal carbon tax structure, but they've been rather focused on incentives to get these abatement opportunities and their low carbon economy moving. So we've got to start to think in that way and how we're going to attract not just, you know, public capital to deliver the reductions that we need as a society, but how we're going to be able to bring private capital and give the certainty that's needed through incentives that so private capital, that power of the Build Back Better can be unleashed in these key sectors. And Alberta needs the, you know, not all, everyone knows the economy in Alberta needs some help, but also it's just a fact that Alberta has the largest carbon emissions by province in the country. So it's really great to see the federal government listen and set up a dialogue on CCUS so that we can get at moving forward in this critical space. Otherwise, we're just going to have our lunch eaten by the United States.
Thank you for that setup of the situation. And Bruce, I want to come back in a minute and ask you about the moving of the targets for 2030. But before we get to that, maybe you should weigh in as well on carbon capture. We see it as a big part of what the International Energy Agency says is the solution set. We see Norway moving ahead, the UK moving ahead, the United States moving ahead, et cetera. You know, to you, is this a necessary and important component to a decarbonization strategy?
Yeah, I mean, to answer that question, Ed, specifically, I would say, yes, it is, but with a number of caveats around that. So if you look at all of the plans that are out there, IEA or some of the big net zero analyses out there, McKinsey, Princeton, you'll see that there's a significant timing issue around carbon capture and storage. There is still considerable research that needs to be done around the technology, the scalability of the technology, the cost of the technology. And so most of these plans have carbon capture and storage playing a very big role as we get closer to 2050, but very little role, in fact, almost no role between now and 2030. So there just needs to be some, you know, cautionary understanding of where carbon capture and storage is going to get us in terms of the reductions. What's interesting, if you look at some of the studies, you'll see that there's, you know, and I think this is also a good sort of precautionary use of the technology, is there's a not unlikely chance that we will, to use a double negative, that we will have trouble getting to our near-term targets, which we'll talk about in a minute, and even our 2050 targets. So that means we will likely have to start pulling carbon out of the air at some point. And again, if you look at these studies, kind of post-2045-ish and post-2050, you'll see a big role for carbon capture to actually be pulling carbon out of the air to get us where we need to get to. So important, but there's a really critical sort of temporal issue to how we understand carbon capture.
I guess that's an interesting lead in to talk about the move of the targets and the 2030 targets to start with, from what was 30% pre-budget to what looked like 36% in the budget to what's 40 to 45% several days later. And I guess Minister Wilkinson has said the 36% provides a floor. He thinks that the policies already in place will get to 36%. So how confident are you that we're, well, I'm going to come back to negative carbon in a few minutes because it's a very interesting part of the conversation. But to start with, you know, how confident are you that these targets are indeed achievable?
It's going to take much more work than most people appreciate if we're going to achieve those targets. One of the reasons I like net zero as a framing is it takes us out of a conversation about targets and we start talking about solutions, transition pathways, where investment needs to take place in a big, big way. So I'm in fact not a huge fan of the target conversation. I think it gets us focused on the, you know, just the idea that we are trying to get rid of these kinds of emissions from these sectors by this date. And ultimately, it can lead to making the wrong kinds of investments that are focused too much on specific technologies and specific sectors to get us to specific numbers by, you know, specific dates. And really we have to look at what are we talking about in terms of big shifts in sectors, big shifts in regional economies, and how do we work in those big, you know, with those big shifts and the kind of investment that's needed to get us to 2050. So 2030 is on the way to 2050, but we can make some really dumb choices trying to chase a 2030 target that might not get us to the big transitional investments we need to get us to 2050.
Sorry, just jump in. I fully agree with Bruce that, you know, the dogma of the targets in some way gets us kind of wrapped up in a conversation. It's almost like the, you know, the perfect becomes the enemy of the good in many ways. And we've got to get moving. The timeliness, 2030 is basically tomorrow. So we have to move very quickly. And I think we've got to be thinking in ways of how do you actually create, the policy won't be perfect right out of the gate. I don't think the, you know, incentive structure or other things won't be perfect out of the gate. But we've got to create the systems to get the massive movement. So you've got to kind of break a few things. So be prepared to break a few things and then recalibrate, you know, as you need to do. This massive movement, and we've seen that in the United States, they've sort of overstimulated their ways of getting at carbon emissions, and we have to think in the same way.
Yeah, and can I just jump in one quick point on that, Ed, too, is I think Canada and the U.S. are in a very different circumstance right now. There are still lots and lots of coal plants in the U.S., and they're mostly ready to be phased out anyway. There's a whole bunch of other reasons to get rid of them, you know, acid rain and other pollutants. So we've largely, you know, done a good job of decarbonizing our electricity system. So it's going to be harder for us even to meet our more modest targets, I think, than the U.S. And the other thing is the U.S. has a whole bunch of really big, sophisticated states that have their own net zero targets and their own investment programs. Unfortunately, in Canada, for the most part, we do not have provinces that are fully bought in on the kind of investment we need to get to net zero. In fact, we've got often, you know, as we've seen, conflicts between the province and the federal government on this.
Right. Well, I guess I'd add to your point that they have some softer targets given their higher preponderance of coal generation that we've largely removed, not completely yet, in Canada. But also, we're still growing in emissions. I mean, the 2019 numbers came in recently, and, you know, we're still going up, and we only have 10 years to come down, and now come down more steeply.
We've only ever gone up.
Yeah. Let me just take a minute. There's we've been asked just to explain some of the acronyms that we're using. And I feel very guilty about this because I'm very anti-acronym for those reasons. So let me just, you guys correct me if I'm wrong. I'll just try to do this quickly. So the idea of carbon capture, you know, you can, Canada has some great geological formations, particularly in Saskatchewan, Alberta, in which some of the best in the world in which to bury carbon. And so there's carbon capture and storage. So that's CCS, if you will. You can also use this carbon for products or for a variety of uses. People hope that you could use it for something called carbon fibers one day, which would be an alternative to steel, et cetera. Basically, you take our carbon disadvantage and you turn it into a carbon. That's the U in CCUS, which is carbon capture utilization and storage. I'm not too sure if you're utilizing it, why you have to store it, but that's one I'll leave for you guys. There's also direct air capture, which Bruce was referring to, particularly when he was talking about taking carbon out of the air. So that's direct air capture. And Canada has some companies, maybe we'll talk about them in a couple of minutes, who are very on the cutting edge in the world on those technologies. And I think the last acronym we used was EOR. And EOR is enhanced oil recovery. It's one of the ways people use carbon. They use it, they put it back in the original place where it kind of came from, and they squeeze out a little bit more oil in doing that, which is not popular with everybody. So those are the acronyms. Now, let's go back, you know, to the targets, I guess, to start with, and what's realistic with those targets. Janet, you know, Bruce said it's going to be very hard to do. What is the oil and gas industry's part of that very hard to do? And should there be an oil and gas part of it, or should we just be easing our way out of oil and gas entirely?
Well, I don't really think that, you know, ultimately the choice about whether we ease our way out of oil and gas is necessarily ours to make. You know, Canada, with all due respect, is a very small market. You know, we're not driving global demand for oil and gas out of Canada. That is something that is happening, you know, in major markets and other jurisdictions. So, you know, we've got to understand our place, I think, in the global energy system and the supply and demand world and the economic world. We do have, as you said, a real, you know, comparative advantage when it comes to many things around oil and gas, both oil and natural gas. And we have a comparative advantage also when it comes to CCUS, I think, built on that oil and gas. Natural gas is plentiful. Right now, it's very low cost. And we also understand the geology very well so that we can sequester carbon emissions, as you pointed out, in Alberta and Saskatchewan. So, you know, long story short, really, the oil and gas sector is an absolute pivotal part of Canada's climate plan. And it has to, as jurisdictions, as an overlay of provinces which have responsibility for natural resources in Canada, but also as you know, economic actors, they have to figure out, we all have to figure out how we're going to address carbon emissions within our oil and gas sector. And there's lots of options. And I think we haven't really taken the time perhaps to look at what the, you know, here I'm going to say it, what the targets are, or what the goals are around decarbonizing our oil and gas sector, where we can position our oil and gas sector to get additional margins and get additional value from decarbonization, you know, under things like low carbon fuel standards, you know, both domestically and internationally. How do we get credit and get value for that? And fundamentally, what is the most, you know, it's not going to be sort of the ultimate most efficient way to deliver capital to do that, but where are the different trade-offs and how do we strategize around some of these issues? So I think we have to have a non, you know, kind of unbiased, very open discussion about how we're going to do that. Because, you know, I think getting entrenched into different camps on things isn't moving us forward. We've got to focus on solutions.
Okay, Bruce, sort of consistent, I guess, with that future, what it looks like. We have the recent Conservative Party announcement of a decarbonization policy in the pre-budget lead up. How credible is that to you, and how significant, which might be a different question, is it?
Yeah, I think it is quite credible and very significant. And the significant part is that I think the Conservative Party, and I really give Erin O'Toole a tremendous amount of credit for clearly going against some of the components of the Conservative Party on this. But I think the Conservative Party of Canada recognizes that they will not get elected ever if they do not have a credible strategy to deal with climate change. And I think they have come up with a credible strategy. So that is important. It's also significant, you know, we saw a number of weeks ago, the Supreme Court of Canada rule that carbon tax was a legal tool of the federal government. And now we've essentially seen Erin O'Toole adopt carbon pricing as a strategy. So as Janet said at the outset, Canada now is actually, you know, among one of the leading countries in the world using carbon pricing as a climate policy tool. And the Conservative Party is now supporting that. And that's just really, really significant. As someone who's worked on carbon pricing for the last 10 years, I think this is very significant. And also it starts to create an environment. If you have things like a carbon tax together with tax credits and then targeted investments in some of the sectors that will help us transition, hydrogen, for example, you know, one we're doing a lot of work on, then you can start to imagine us getting to the targets. And so when I said it's good, I don't think getting to the targets will be impossible. I think it'll be impossible with some of our current thinking, but it's not impossible. So yes, I'm just really pleased to see this. And I think it's a big breakthrough for the country.
Well, I guess, you know, if the Conservative Party is in that position now, and, you know, obviously not everybody in the Conservative Party, but if the Conservative Party is, you know, certainly moving in that direction, if Alberta seems to be moving in that direction, I guess that underlines the point that you're making earlier, that we're moving into the solutions phase, from the problem phase into the solutions phase. And Janet, that's the way it feels to you in Alberta, that we're moving out of this, you know, strong oppositional phase into solutions phase as well?
Well, you know, I think it all depends on, you know, perception is very relative to where one sits. You know, as someone who's worked in the oil and gas industry, worked in public policy, I always have felt that, you know, most of the oil and gas industry has actually been in the solutions phase for a very long time. In fact, you know, really has tons of appreciation for the complexity of these issues and the problem. So I think we're now just trying to get an assessment of, you know, that idea that a plan with or a vision without a plan is just a dream. You know, we've got these targets and goals. We've now got to really figure out how to get there and have a conversation about that. So I think that people are now embracing some of the complexity, starting to kind of see the way that, you know, especially with the United States now becoming a more serious actor with some of the plans that Biden has announced. And, you know, we've got to get our act together and figure out how we're going to come in alongside in a North American energy system to be a part of this. So I think we've always been kind of in the solution space. I certainly think the people around me have. But, you know, I think we're getting more serious about not just dabbling. We've got to, you know, move some things forward.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to just take a moment to remind people who've joined us that I'd love to have your participation, love to have your questions. Use the raised hand feature on Zoom, or put your question to the chat, or put that I want to ask a question into the chat. I got more people than I have screen room at the moment, so it'd probably be good just to, you know, signal to me. And please turn on your camera if you're planning to join in the conversation, and I welcome that. I will ask question two as we're getting there, but I'd like to transition here, okay? Let's go back to the idea of negative carbon for a minute, and let's go back to some of the companies that Canada has who are active in this space. carbon engineering, carbon cure, which works with cement companies and won a huge international prize in the past week, Svanti. There's a number of companies that are quite active, and some of them in doing that direct air capture, Bruce. So I guess for both of you, I guess what I want to know is, to what extent is carbon capture a sunk cost of the public sector because there's a public good in getting carbon out? And to what extent is this a business opportunity in building a competitive advantage for Canada?
Well, maybe I'll start off. I think it's both. You know, it's one thing that, you know, we've got to start think, you know, challenge ourselves on sometimes on this, the solution set is deciding as sort of central, almost like a centrally planned economy, what the solutions are going to be. But we also maybe have an opportunity to think about how do we create the incentive structure that lets the market come in behind these technologies, behind specific companies where they think it's not just going to be a solution here in Canada, but there is that global market out there. And, you know, you pointed out that we've got some great innovation here and, you know, we should be thinking, and I think private capital with the right incentive structure, both in Canada and beyond, would look at those as really, really great investments for the future. So I think we can have it a bit both ways. We can kind of look at some of this as a bit of a public cost and a public utility. But on the other hand, we have to have markets come in and leverage private capital to get these things to take off. And we're well positioned in Canada. We just got to kind of get out of our own way.
Bruce, you want to add to that?
Yeah, sure. I think primarily this has to be a private sector funded endeavor. You know, the first convention on climate change was signed almost 30 years ago. I think the oil industry has had ample opportunity over 30 years to invest many of the hundreds of billions of dollars of profit that they've made, thanks to governments leasing them properties to make that profit. And so I would have a lot of trouble if now suddenly after billions and billions of dollars in profit has left our country, that the government now has to put public dollars into, you know, extending the life of the oil industry here. So I get to, for a lot of the other solutions, I think we do need public dollars. And so there's certainly a role for it. And I think there will be companies, and this is where, again, like a carbon tax is going to make a huge difference. A lot of the research we've seen shows that once our carbon tax starts hitting $60, $70, $80, that's going to trigger a lot of private investment in carbon capture technology. And my preference would be to wait until we're at the point where it makes sense for the market and not be putting a lot of public dollars into this.
Maybe the only, you know, comment I'd have on what Bruce just said is, you know, I think there is a commercialization or a cost curve here. You know, we've got to take into consideration. I think there, you know, private capital, unfortunately, in some cases is gonna wait. Nobody really wants to be the first mover and take on. I used to spent 10 years at Shell Canada, and part of my job while I was there was working a lot on the Shell Quest carbon capture an underground storage project. And Shell, you know, took those costs on, of course, with a great deal of funding from both the provincial and federal government. But, you know, I think, you know, we can't just expect to wake up one day in 2029 and we're going to have, you know, CCUS that's operating efficiently, that we're going to have, you know, shared infrastructure that is at capacity, you know, with low costs. You know, it's just, we have to start somewhere. And then, you know, we're going to have to, again, in the U.S., they're incentivizing this. So if the competitive position is that we have to likewise look at it that way, I don't think the stick approach solely is going to work. And, you know, we also do enjoy benefits from the oil and gas sector. We enjoy revenues that support our quality of life, our, you know, a lot of, you know, not just, you know, pension funds and other investors that enjoy returns on those investments, but also the, you know, great deal of royalties and taxes come off of this industry. So yes, well, you know, investors maybe outside the boundaries of our country and profiting from that, you know, I don't think that's, you know, necessarily the reason why we shouldn't support the industry going forward. We have to look at the broader value proposition.
Yeah, I guess there's two figures that have jumped out at me over the last couple of years that make me think that the oil and gas industry needs to be part of the solution. I mean, maybe there's three figures. One figure is 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees, you know. So, you know, the first figure is that we need to do something and expeditiously on climate change. It's maybe a little late to act expeditiously, but you can only start accelerating today. But the other two figures are that I think the number is 96.5% of passenger vehicles sold in Canada last year were internal combustion engines. And those last on average about 15 years. So no matter how this transition occurs, and I'm sure, Bruce, you might want to talk about mandates and being more aggressive on electric vehicles as we may, but there's going to be oil in the market for a long time to come. And the other figure is $76.6 billion, which is Canada runs a current account deficit with the world, and we have for 12 years running of about $50, $60 billion. But energy contributes net positive of $76.5 billion to what otherwise is a deficit. And almost all of that is oil and gas. So we would have a macroeconomic effect if we pulled back on that lever too quickly.
Yeah, I agree, which is partly, you know, I'm just, you know, to make a point, I think we should have been doing more of this kind of work for the last 10 years. I think there's just been a lot of sitting on hands and delay and, you know, and partly a lack of understanding of where all this was going from a lot of quarters. So, you know, someone that's been working on this stuff for 25 years, it is a little frustrating to watch how slowly we've moved. So that's reflected in my comments. At the same time, you know, clearly, I mean, it's a little bit ironic to say, you know, we don't, you know, everyone's afraid we're going to pull the switch too quickly. We've never pulled a switch. So let's start bending the curve. Let's start making some big investments. Let's start showing that we're actually doing some work. And I think I'd point out too that, you know, talking about the growth in emissions, you know, the bulk of the growth in the emissions in our emission for the last number of years has been from the oil and gas sector. So the oil and gas sector is really where we need to really understand, you know, both the, I mean, there's regional economic issues, as you've said, Ed, there's national issues for the country, there's trade issues, there's a ton of issues there. So I mean, it needs a great deal of thought and analysis and careful planning. I'm not suggesting that we do anything rash, but at the same time, we have to understand that that is where we need to put a lot of attention right now. So, I think we as in sort of nationally of the country, we use Alberta as an excuse not to take action. And I think now we're starting to see action. And so clearly Alberta and the oil and gas sector have to be at the table for that.
I guess they have the most at stake and could get caught the hardest on the line change that's happening here with 26% of our emissions coming from oil and gas production.
Yeah.
And the second largest amount is from transportation, of which vehicles are such a huge part. So clearly they have to be at that table. I want to just stick with vehicles for a moment. And, you know, there will be a shift towards electric vehicles, despite what I say. We have international auto manufacturers saying rather aggressively that they will move to targets. We're having countries and states in the United States creating down mandate of electric cars. Is Canada, which has a great deal at stake, of course, is because our supply chains, particularly in central Canada, are so tied to the industry as it is. Is Canada moving aggressively enough toward this new world, Bruce?
No, I'd say definitely not. That was one of the, to me, most exciting parts of the Conservative plan was a zero emission vehicle mandate. You know, we've done quite a lot of work on this, and we're actually supporting an electric vehicle supply chain sort of alliance in Canada and, you know, living in Ontario. I mean, for Ontario, the closest thing we have to the oil industry is the auto industry, right? Huge export economy, huge employer, huge, you know, sort of historical, you know, industrial player. So we have a real interest in making sure that we maintain that economic activity. And I think governments have been really slow to act, way behind the ball. You know, we've seen some recent stuff, you know, the Unifor and Ford announcements and others that I think are very important. So, and Canada is well positioned in terms of metals and minerals to be supplying the electric vehicle supply chain, which is sort of part of what's behind the work we're doing. So really important. But if you look at the experience in California, for example, who, you know, there's, I would say, no other jurisdiction in the world that understands how you get technology adopted quickly. And it's largely through things like dev mandates and a sophisticated combination of everything from understanding the role of dealers to vehicle insurance to the after sales market. Like it's very, very complex. And I'm not seeing much evidence of that, like the complexity of that understanding in Canada.
Okay, well, speaking of the auto industry in Unifor, we have the former chief economist of the union in the audience who has a question that he'd like to ask. So I go to Jim Stanford.
Ed, I was the only economist at Unifor, not the chief economist. So.
Yeah, I was once the Prairie Bureau chief of the Financial Post of Canada, and I understand the situation, but I was more immodest than you. Jim.
Well, I didn't have a specific question, Ed. I was just kind of jumping into the discussion there on the point that you raised earlier about the trade balance and the important role, obviously, today that petroleum exports play in that. I don't lose sleep over that angle of it at night, in part because there are some offsetting and balancing effects that go on. Number one, the petroleum industry itself is largely foreign-owned, so there's an ongoing export of interest and dividend and profit income that Bruce alluded to earlier. And then the part of the net trade impact depends on how much capital equipment was being imported for those petroleum projects. So I don't think it's going to be a macro shock. Number one, it's not going to happen overnight. Number two, there's lots of different things that adjust in an economy as a change like that is happening. You know, it wasn't that long ago, for example, that autos were our biggest export by far, and that has fallen. But the impacts of that were not really felt through the foreign exchange account. One thing I just wanted to engage with Bruce maybe on is this issue of, is it going to be the private sector or the public sector that leads? And, you know, I hear you on the issue of, you know, not wanting to bail out of the petroleum sector. On the other hand, there is experience to show that co-investment in a capital sense can A, make it happen, and B, stimulate more of the upfront economic activity that would be very useful coming out of the pandemic. So, I don't know, would you think about what an appropriate role for public investment, not necessarily just subsidies, but public investment in some of these projects might be?
Yeah, no, that's interesting. And I'm far from opposed to public investment. I think it was just a little bit more my the issue around the opportunity for private investment that's been missed over the last number of years in some of this technology development. But certainly if we're going to be, and my preference is to really figure out how we invest in, you know, essentially we've got two things happening. We've got, you know, the gradual decline of the existing energy system and the gradual increase of new kinds of energy systems. And, you know, my preference would be that we're making most of our public investments in the new energy systems. So we need a lot of public investment in electrification, you know, building electrification, the rigor of the electricity grid, all of that is really, you know, ripe for opportunity of public investment. We saw the Canada Infrastructure Bank just make a big investment on that related to that. And then things like the hydrogen economy, like we're gonna need a lot of public investment. And I would say exactly private, you know, private public co-investment in the kinds of infrastructure that we need to build out. Like I would love to see Alberta be the North American global leader for hydrogen fuel production, for example. And that requires all of the same skills and technologies and assets that Alberta has in terms of storage, distribution, pipes, the labor force. But it's going to take a bunch of public investment to get us there. So I'm not at all opposed to public investment.
Yeah, let me go to Janet on this same question, because I'm just wondering to what extent you're seeing companies looking at reinventing themselves to some extent in the way that Bruce and Jim are talking as carbon capture companies, as hydrogen companies. And of course, carbon capture is a necessary component of hydrogen from natural gas, as it is a necessary component, you know, to capturing steel and cement emissions and other heavy emitters. So do you see a different mentality in how a company conceives of itself today out there?
Yes and no. I think there's an interesting sort of distribution across the value chain of oil and gas in that regard. You know, what the challenge for, I think, all companies right now, regardless of sector, though, is on certainty of policy, and therefore, and that could be the carbon tax, you know, so do they know for sure it'll be $170 a ton? You know, how do they plan for that? You know, if you're going to kick off a project today and you're not getting $170 a ton, how do you then, you know, justify your investment? And really the carbon tax right now is not high enough to stimulate those kinds of investments that we're talking about for CCUS. So we need other things. And so the public, the public structure does need to invest, but how that is structured is very important in terms of, you know, putting in floor prices, for example, you know, through credits. And, you know, that way people can be assured of a certain return that actually helps them access low cost capital to be, you know, as efficient as they can be in investing. And, you know, if you can get that going, so you have to get it, you know, that action is very important, kind of breaking through the inertia so that we can start to commercialize some of these things. So the market will work, Ed, I think, and at the end of the day, you know, whether if the opportunity is in blue hydrogen and people can get a premium for that in a domestic market or potentially in an international market, or if they can use carbon for a new carbon fuel and get a premium in RIN provinces, which reward a low carbon content with a premium. So I think, you know, and that's where EOR fits in. It's like, you know, again, there's a revenue stream there. So, well, maybe EOR isn't the reason to have the investment tax credit, you know, looking at the idea you have another revenue stream coming in that helps those projects get over an investment hurdle rate and actually go. So, you know, I think there's, the market will work. I don't think it's up to a sectoral strategy to say the oil sands needs to do this, the natural gas sector needs to have blue hydrogen to do that. You put the right structure in place and it will go.
Okay, well, policy and markets working together, the way the world actually really goes round. So I want to thank Janet and I want to thank Bruce for their insights today. We have, what year are we in? 2021. So we have 29 years to get to net zero. It'd be good to be one of the first countries in the world to get to net zero, not one of the last. Maybe that would be a good objective for me to have. But I think the main point is we're going to have plenty of opportunity along the way to discuss the issues and the trade-offs again. So thank you for your presence today, and we look forward to welcoming you back again. Now I'd like to highlight this week yet another one of the excellent contributions that our PPF members are making to a better Canada. We are PPF proud this week of our member McKinsey & Company for its current initiative, the McKinsey Achievement Awards. These awards aim to recognize and support talented individuals around the world whose backgrounds may be underrepresented in leadership roles. And we know there's too much of that. Applications are now open to professionals with fewer than 5 years of work experience or current students working towards an undergraduate or graduate degree. Winners will join the McKinsey Mentorship Program and will get a $2,500 sponsorship toward academic or professional development. So this is a wonderful opportunity, and we want to thank McKinsey for this important work promoting equity, diversity, and inclusion, in addition to all of its other outstanding research. PPF, as you know, is a membership-based organization. If you're not a member, well, we wonder what you're waiting for. We want to have you on board. We want to have your intelligence in our network and influencing us and informing us as we try to inform policy decision makers. So please visit the membership page of our website, ppforum.ca, to find out more. That is a wrap of another edition of Policy Speaking. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review, share the episode with a friend, let us know on Twitter at ppforumca. I want to thank my colleagues at the Public Policy Forum who make this podcast happen. Until next time, I'm Edward Greenspan, and this has been Policy Speaking.